We should also remind people that when asked for his worldview, when Mike Johnson became Speaker of the House, nobody knew anything about him. He said, you want to know my worldview? Go read the Bible. That's what I stand for. And now today, he's down at the courthouse in Lower Manhattan defending the guy who's on trial for allegedly paying off a porn star for the alleged affair he had while his wife was home with their infant son.
I think there's something in the Bible about that, about porn stars, isn't there?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Maybe I'm reading the wrong Bible.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
The drop Bible.
Yeah.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, mercy. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington, where we have an interesting story today, on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. We always have interesting stories out of Wisconsin. And yes, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. You heard that comment there about Mike Johnson, who is, I guess, today's chosen one for Donald Trump's criminal trial up in New York.
Yes, among many surrogates who've decided to show up, all wearing the same uniform, a red tie.
And is that right?
Yep.
And, of course, helping Donald Trump to violate his gag order, apparently. A gag order which a New York appeals court on Tuesday upheld, barring Donald Trump from making statements attacking witnesses, jurors, and family members of prosecutors and court staff in the disgraced former president's ongoing criminal trial there on 34 felony counts of falsifying business documents in order to hide his hush money payments to a porn star just before the 2016 election in order to help him win it. As far as I know, that gag order also prevents him from causing someone else to violate that gag order. But we will see. His former attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, continued his testimony on Tuesday in both direct and cross-examination. That testimony will continue on Thursday, I believe, and we will try to get you all caught up on any noteworthy news from the trial during our midweek catch-up with a K coverage on our next broadcast.
Yes.
I believe. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, voters in Nebraska, Maryland, and West Virginia took to the polls for primary elections, where, although the presidential contests are now all but settled, with both Joe Biden and Donald Trump having won enough delegates to be officially nominated at their conventions this summer, there are a whole bunch of important races on the ballot in all three states. For example, there is a hotly contested Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in Maryland to run against the state's popular former moderate Republican governor, Larry Hogan, who hope to fill the seat of retiring Democratic Senator Ben Cardin. There's a hotly contested Democratic race with more than 20 Democrats vying for the nomination to fill the seat of retiring Democratic Congressman John Sarbanes in Maryland. One of those contestants is Harry Dunn, the Capitol Police officer who battled Trump insurrectionists on January 6th. There's a Republican contest in Nebraska's purplish Omaha area, pitting a sitting, not entirely insane Republican congressman against a Trump-endorsed MAGA challenger, which, if the latter wins the nomination, could end up handing the seat to a Democratic state senator by the name of Tony Vargas, who nearly won the seat back in 22. And, of course, in West Virginia, the race for the nomination on both sides of the aisle to fill the seat of retiring right-wing Democratic senator and coal baron Joe Manchin in West Virginia, featuring at least one coal baron on both the Republican and Democratic side, of course, though the one on the Democratic side, Don Blankenship is his name, is actually a right-wing Republican loon who served time in prison for his coal company's responsibility for an explosion that killed some 29 miners, I believe it was.
29, Big Branch Mine.
Back in 2010, as I recall, Blankenship lost his race for the U.S. Senate against Manchin when Blankenship was running as a Republican last time Manchin was up for re-election in 2018. So far, not too many reports of problems for voters at the polls on Tuesday, though in Maryland, there have been some reports of a handful of polling places not opening on time in Baltimore and Prince George's County on Tuesday morning. We'll keep an eye out for additional concerns, and we'll have any noteworthy results and or problems at the polls or during tabulation, as rare as they have been for most of the primary season to date, on our next broadcast. And while the lack of problems for voters during largely low turnout primary elections so far this year has been kind of nice, the dirty tricks and the voter suppression, which seem to just be getting started, well, that's another matter. And in this case, our first story, it's not rogue right-wing activists who are pulling off these dirty tricks, but the GOP-controlled state legislature in the former battleground state of Ohio. Maybe former and future battleground? This is a story that we first reported on some weeks ago, suggesting that it seemed so ridiculous at the time that I wasn't even sure if it was worth covering back then. But sadly, in the ensuing weeks, this ridiculous story has not become any less ridiculous, but it has become more of an actual issue, I think. Several weeks ago, we reported on several states, most notably Ohio, which had legislative deadlines for adding presidential candidates to their ballots. In Ohio's case, the Republican and Democratic parties must inform the state of their official party nominees for president 90 days before the general election. But this year, the Democratic Party convention, when they're set to officially nominate President Biden as their nominee for re-election, that won't happen until 74 days before the November election. Now, in fact, that is not unusual. It has happened many times before and, as noted, in other states as well, such as Washington State and Alabama. They have similar laws. And in most cases, legislators just sort of pass a simple legislative fix to assure that the two major parties have their nominees on the ballot. And since we last covered this story, both Washington and Alabama have done so. Alabama did so very quietly last week. And Ohio itself has done so many times in the past. In 2020, they extended that deadline to allow Republican Donald Trump to be on the ballot, even though Republicans held a later convention that year. They also did the same thing back in 2012 for Mitt Romney, even back in 2008 for Barack Obama. Before, I guess, the state took its far-right turn after the 2010 census redistricting and the extreme gerrymandering that went along with it. But while even Alabama lawmakers were able to pass a quick bill to allow Biden on the state's ballot this year, so far, Ohio has not. The state's legislature had until the end of its legislative session last week to do so. But because the Ohio legislature is an extreme partisan gerrymander with Republicans firmly in control of both chambers, I believe they have supermajorities in both of them, and because many of them are actually petulant far-right Trumpers, well, they failed to pass two different pieces of legislation last week to take care of this problem. One had already passed in the state Senate to extend the deadline so that President Biden would be on the ballot in Ohio this year, a state that until recent years had been considered a swing state. As AP's Julie Smythe reports, the question of whether Democratic President Joe Biden will appear on Ohio's fall ballot has become entangled in a partisan legislative fight to keep money from foreign nationals out of state ballot campaigns, a year after cash tied to a Swiss billionaire boosted a successful effort to enshrine abortion rights in the otherwise solidly red state's constitution. In other words, even though many of these same lawmakers had expressed outrage about the possibility of Donald Trump being removed from the ballot for violating the Constitution's 14th Amendment insurrectionist disqualification clause, after a full trial with witnesses and evidence was carried out in Colorado and confirmed by its highest court, Republicans in Ohio were against that, but they are seemingly just fine with leaving Joe Biden off the ballot due to the Democratic Party's convention missing an arbitrary state deadline that they have waived many times in the past. Or at least, if they're going to put him on the ballot, they are insisting on a pound of flesh in return from Democrats before doing so, for the first time in state history. Last week, against a backdrop of festering Republican leadership fights that's roiled lawmaking since last year, reports AP, Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose's proposal to ban foreign money from initiative campaigns became the poison pill that prevented a solution for adjusting the August 7 ballot deadline that precedes the Democratic National Convention. With that, the final day passed during the legislative session in which legislators could pass a fix with just a simple majority. To do so now would require a two-thirds majority. Republicans could do that, but so far they have shown no signs of a plan to actually carry it out. All four Republican and Democratic leaders at the State House still say that they're confident the president will appear on Ohio's ballot, though no one seems to be certain as to how that it will actually happen at this point. Senate Republicans had tried to use Biden's predicament as a leverage to pass a ban on foreign nationals contributing to state ballot campaigns. At the heart of the issue, as the New York Times reports, is a partisan fight over donations by foreign nationals in support of ballot initiatives in Ohio. Republicans insist in the state that it was foreign nationals who they blamed for the passage last year of that constitutional amendment in Ohio enshrining access to abortion. A guy by the name of Hans-Jörg Weiss, a Swiss billionaire who was born in Switzerland in 1935. Apparently, he now lives in Wyoming. Turns out he's a major donor to one of the progressive groups that campaigned in Ohio to support that abortion measure, and Republicans have repeatedly singled out Mr. Weiss as a target of this particular proposed ban. Republicans in Ohio have said that passing the ban on foreign donations is the price that Democrats must pay to ensure that Mr. Biden is on the ballot in the state. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who is still smarting from having changed his advocacy against special elections in August in order to allow one to happen last year that would have made it harder to pass the abortion rights measure that was previously scheduled for last November, which easily passed after LaRose's measure failed miserably in August last year. LaRose is sort of still smarting from losing that and from losing the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate this year to run against Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. LaRose said last week, quote, "There's one person at this point who's responsible for keeping Joe Biden off the ballot in Ohio. And it's a Swiss billionaire you've probably never heard of," he said. It's his fault. It's his fault. LaRose alleged Democrats have, quote, "become dependent on Vice's dark money to fund everything from their ballot campaigns to their fake news operations." And you know how Republicans just hate dark money.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Fake news operations.
I mean, they're totally okay with big Republican mega donors donating to unaccountable dark money groups
for passing Republican agenda
and Republican candidates. But gosh, when donors donate to a progressive group, oh my God, we have to stop that.
We have to not only stop that, we have to take the presidential nominee off the ballot in the state of Ohio. State Senator Bill DeMora, a Democrat, accused LaRose of politicizing his office, said blaming Democrats for the lack of a ballot resolution is, quote, "almost so sad it's funny." "It is not the Democrats' fault that the Republicans are infighting and can't govern, but the secretary is just trying to please right-wing extremists instead of doing his job to avoid further embarrassment," said DeMora in a statement. "This debacle falls squarely on the MAGA cult Republican supermajority in both chambers who only hold power because of the unconstitutionally gerrymandered maps that LaRose voted for." Among the solutions that legislators at this point could take to fix this problem, according to the State House News Bureau, is either add a clause to legislation with a two-thirds majority to do so. Republicans have supermajorities in both chambers, so they could do it. Or Democrats in the Biden campaign could, and I suspect this is what will probably happen, they could turn to the courts as an option, given that, you know, just a few months ago, the corrupted right-wing Supreme Court said that Colorado could not remove Donald Trump from the ballot, even though he was in clear violation of the U.S. Constitution's insurrection clause because, well, in a rule that the Supreme Court just made up out of whole cloth, they said states can't decide on their own who can or can't run on the ballot in presidential contests. A ruling that Ohio Republicans seem to be simply ignoring right about now. That battle, by the way, over the Colorado matter and Donald Trump, that took about 5 months to be resolved by the Supreme Court. So Democrats in the Biden campaign would have to sort of get busy right now, costing them a lot of time and money in the bargain. David Cohen, a political science professor at the University of Akron, told The Hill, quote, "Republicans don't get any electoral benefit from keeping Biden's name off the ballot, so why would they do it?" he asked. "I think if they did that," he said, "it would infuriate so many Democrats and, more importantly, independents here that they might as well just give Senator Sherrod Brown the election before Election Day." Dan Birdsong, a lecturer in the Department of Political Sciences at the University of Dayton, who published a column pushing for legislators to change the deadline to certify the ballot, argued that the effect of keeping Biden off the ballot could also hurt Republicans. Quote, "Electorally, you want to run against someone," he said. "You have both who I'm voting for and who I'm running against, which has helped motivate some people," he added. So I don't know. Maybe it's just as well Joe Biden's off the ballot in Ohio, at least for now. But this is the kind of thing that I think we can expect this year all over the place from a party that no longer has any central policy-based governing philosophy. Their governing philosophy is no longer based on policy, but simply on retaining power. Anything they can do, frankly, lawful or unlawful, to retain power, that's it. That's their that's the Republican governing philosophy at this point. And they are to exercise that power to the benefit of, frankly, whichever industry or billionaires give them the most money to exercise their power on their behalf once they are in office. you know, why bother trying to win over voters when you can just use dirty tricks to keep someone off the ballot? You can use extreme gerrymandering to make it impossible for the opponents to win. Or you can just prevent voters from voting at all, any way you can think of. Or even, as we see in Washington State now, you can just try to confuse the hell out of voters about who is actually on the ballot in any given race. According to KIRO in Seattle's in Seattle, their original story on Monday began this way. There are three Bob Fergusons running for Washington State governor. One of them is the state attorney general, the Democratic frontrunner in the race to take over for longtime Democratic Governor Jay Inslee, who chose to retire this year. And that Bob Ferguson is calling the addition of two more Bob Fergusons on the ballot a dirty trick and an illegal scheme with an effort to confuse voters. I understand the confusing voters part, but an illegal scheme? He said, this is a threat to our election system. That's the Bob Ferguson state attorney general on Monday morning. Now, there's a total of 30 candidates running for state governor of all parties, as the state has recently moved to a top two primary system, similar to the one we now have out here in California, which we discussed on yesterday's program when there was a tie for the second place spot in a U.S. House race from our Super Tuesday primary back in March. In Washington, the two additional Bob Fergusons had filed for the ballot on Friday afternoon, just prior to the 5 p.m. deadline for signing up for the ballot. One Bob Ferguson is a retired state employee from Yakima, and the other is a military veteran from Graham, Washington. According to the state attorney general, cease and desist letters were hand-delivered to the homes of the other two Robert Fergusons yesterday, urging them to withdraw by the dropout deadline, which was 5 o'clock on Monday. As the Seattle Times reported on Monday, the state's candidate filing week ended in chaos on Friday.
I'll bet.
When the field of candidates for governor increased by two more Bob Fergusons. Their entrance into the race, they report, was apparently orchestrated by a Republican activist by the name of Glenn Morgan, who announced on social media, quote, yes, I am the volunteer campaign manager for two of the Bob Fergusons running for governor. They are both superior in every way to the attorney general running for the same office, and I believe they can provide better choices for the Democrats in our state for that office. I know that Republican activist is concerned about the best choices for Democrats in the state of Washington.
Yeah, that statement was dripping with sincerity.
The attorney general on Monday urged the two to pull out by the 5 p.m. deadline on Monday or else risk felony charges. Felony charges? For applying to be on the ballot? Well, yes, apparently so. State statute in Washington says that it's a felony for a person to file for an election with a surname similar to a person who has already filed for the same office, quote, and whose political reputation is widely known with intent to confuse and mislead the electors by capitalizing on the public reputation of the candidate who had previously filed. That's already a state law in Washington.
Which makes you wonder how that happened historically.
How many times has this happened before? That they had the lawmakers had to make a law about it. Anyway, a statement posted on the website Neighbors for Bob Ferguson PAC. That's not the Attorney General Bob Ferguson. A statement posted to that website attributed to Robert Ferguson, the Army veteran from Graham, said the candidate was, quote, faced with harassment and legal action if I did not withdraw from the race. I was publicly labeled a threat to democracy by another candidate and his supporters, Ferguson said in the Monday statement. You can pick which Ferguson you want. Anyway, he said, quote, in a typical hypocritical fashion, this other candidate's actions are the true threat to democracy. I believe this shows that the other candidate fears he has not effectively done enough to stand out, or that he thinks voters are not competent enough to think for themselves. Yes. Dirty tricks. The statement by that Bob Robert Ferguson went on to say it was unfair to his family and supporters to deal with, quote, bullish behavior by someone that is too afraid to stand toe-to-toe with me. Now, Ferguson, the attorney general, said Monday he didn't want the other two Bobs to be prosecuted and that he held no ill will toward them, but he had suspected they did not know the legal implications of their actions when they agreed to file for election. He said, if they do not do the right thing, and they're surely aware of the legal implications now, we'll have no choice but to take more serious steps and ask local prosecutors to do the right thing and further pursue further action. His campaign had planned to ask the Secretary of State to include his and the other Ferguson's occupations on the ballot, that the other Ferguson's be referred to as Robert, and that it include their middle initial or middle name. The other two Fergusons had been slated to appear second and third on the ballot, with the AG down in slot number 13. That was determined by a random draw on Friday, but that could have been tough. By the time the deadline to drop out arrived on Monday, the state's longtime AG once again became the lone Bob Ferguson in the race for governor after the other two Bobs, yes, withdrew from the race, citing the pressure from the AG, Bob Ferguson. The Bob Ferguson, who's a retired state employee from Yakima, withdrew and offered a statement to the Seattle Times saying that, quote, his dream had been, quote, destroyed. He said he had a political platform, policy position that would have given Democrats a better choice than our state's lawless AG could ever provide. He says, I'm sorry, I've illegally been denied this opportunity to live my dream and share these with the public. But there was no way he could afford the legal costs necessary to defend the, quote, massive threatening power of the state, the billionaires, or the other rich elite who clearly enjoy hurting us. So, with the other Bobs out, the attorney general will now appear in slot number 11 on the ballot. According to the Secretary of State, Washington's primary is August 6. The top two candidates will advance to the general election regardless of party in that primary. And, you know, I suspect we are just sort of now getting started with these sort of dirty tricks that we're going to see this year. And then, of course, the dirty tricks, well, they aren't the only other thing than, you know, trying to sell popular policies to voters. I know that's a quaint idea, crazy idea at this point. But yeah, it's not just dirty tricks that Republicans are employing this year to try and win by, you know, instead gaming elections. And of course, one of our favorite battleground states, great state of Georgia, is determined to be at the center of that. Last week, the state's Republican governor, Brian Kemp, signed new legislation that makes additional changes to Georgia's election laws ahead of the 2024 presidential contest, including defining probable causes for removing voters from the rolls when their eligibility is challenged. Republican activists, fueled by debunked theories of stolen elections, of a stolen election, specifically in 2020, have challenged more than 100,000 voters in the state in recent years under the current laws. In a state which Joe Biden won in 2020 by just about 22,000 votes. These right-wing activists say they're simply rooting out duplicate records, removing voters who have moved out of the state. But the bill that Kemp signed into law, known as SB 189, lists a bunch of new probable causes such as death, evidence of voting or registering in another jurisdiction, a tax exemption indicating a primary residence elsewhere or a non-residential address as probable causes for removing voters from the rolls. Most controversially, it says the national change of address list can be considered, though not exclusively. Opponents of the measure say the changes would enable more baseless attacks on voters that would overwhelm election administrators and disenfranchise legitimate voters. For example, people sometimes live at a place of business, which would be considered a non-residential address. And so good luck defending yourself to be able to vote this year or to fight being removed from the ballot inappropriately. The new Georgia bill also allows challenges to be accepted and voters removed from the rolls right up until 45 days before an election, which is interesting because that has prompted threats of lawsuit from voting rights groups because federal law states and that counties can't make systematic changes to voting rolls within 90 days of a federal election.
Yeah, because you have to give voters a chance to remedy the situation once they find out you purged them from the rolls.
Well, apparently Georgia thinks federal law doesn't matter. They're changing that to 45 days.
Well, it's going to
sue
take,
us.
Yeah, it'll take time to wend its way through the courts. So maybe it'll get done before the election.
The measure also says homeless people must use county voter registration offices as their address instead of where they may actually live. Opponents have said that could make it harder for homeless citizens to cast ballots because their registered polling place might be far away from where they live if they have to make it all the way to a county office somewhere.
And good luck getting that information out to them.
Fair Fight Action, the voting rights group founded by former Democratic Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, slammed the signing of the bill, calling the measure a, quote, voter suppression bill that emboldens right-wing activists in their efforts to kick black and brown voters off the rolls. By signing SB 189, Brian Kemp delivered a gift to MAGA election deniers, the group said in a statement. Andrea Young, the executive director of ACLU of Georgia, called the bill a, quote, step back for voters' rights and voting access. Quote, we are committed to protecting Georgia voters, and we will see the governor in court, she said in a statement. And there is also this. The bill also grants access to Georgia's ballot to any political party that has qualified for the presidential ballot in at least 20 states or territories, which could bolster independent candidates, for example, such as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the ballot in Georgia, where I know they're always very concerned about ballot access. And also, there is this. We discussed this part of the bill with longtime election integrity advocate Marilyn Marks on the show last week, just before Brian Kemp would eventually sign this bill in Georgia. It says that beginning July 1 of 2026, the state can no longer use a kind of barcode called a QR code to count ballots that are created by the state's touchscreen ballot marking devices. Those are the fully unverifiable and easily manipulated touchscreen voting systems that the Georgia Secretary of State now forces on all voters at every poll in the state, in which Maryland's group, the Coalition for Good Governance, has had a long-standing federal lawsuit to try to get rid of. They finished their trial on that matter earlier this year, but as we discussed with her last week, the federal judge has yet to issue a verdict in that matter. But those QR codes that are printed on the ballot that are used for tabulation cannot be read by humans. It's how the votes are printed by the touchscreen computers. It's how those votes are currently tallied. There's also human readable language on the ballot, and so you can sort of try to verify that it didn't misprint your ballot, but it doesn't matter because the QR codes are counted, not the human readable stuff. Nonetheless, getting rid of the QR codes, as this measure supposedly does in 2026, as Marilyn has pointed out for years, even getting rid of those codes leaves it still impossible to know after an election if any of the ballots were actually verified by any voter. That's the problem with touchscreen voting systems that print out ballots.
Well, that print out your ballot selections. You could print out a blank ballot and have people fill it out, but a ballot selection.
And well, you have no idea if those ballot selections are what the voters actually selected.
Exactly.
And most voters don't review them. Even if they do, about 80% of them don't notice when the computer has flipped one of their votes, according to a number of studies now. So anyway, don't get too excited about that part of this otherwise new lousy voter suppression law that was passed in Georgia. It's second such bill since the 2020 election. As you will recall, the previous one, among other things, makes it a violation of law to give food or water to someone waiting in line for hours to vote in Georgia. And they have a lot of lines in Georgia, thanks in no small part to the terrible touchscreen voting systems, which make it take even longer to cast one's vote. The bill also requires counties to report the results of all absentee ballots by an hour after polls close. 1 hour after polls close, you have to know the results of all the absentee ballots. Kemp, on the other hand, also vetoed, I should note, a separate election bill that would ban political contributions by foreign nationals. You know, a measure akin to the one that Republicans in Ohio are using for now to try and keep Joe Biden off the ballot in that state. Though those were contributions, as I understand it, made to nonpartisan organizations. Kemp here notes that donations are already prohibited to candidates in any event by federal law. So I guess good for him vetoing that one. Anyway, the horse race continues. The track is still very, very sloppy. That thanks to those guys on the side of the track who are hosing it down with as much water as they can possibly find.
Yep, and they'll keep doing it.
Anyway, there's your track conditions for today. Let's take a quick break. We're back with some brighter 2024 track condition news ahead, plus Desi Doyen and her latest Green News report to ruin it all. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Welcome back. It's Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It seems to me that Republicans in the great state of Wisconsin are having a very, very difficult time with all the changes that seem to be coming to the state now that liberals have taken a majority on the state Supreme Court after right-wingers have controlled it for almost 15 years now. The liberals who control the Wisconsin Supreme Court, according to Washington Post's coverage on this story yesterday, signaled on Monday that they were prepared to overturn a 2-year-old decision that banned absentee ballot drop boxes. Remember that decision? And to allow them for the 2024 election in the critical Badger state. As reported by the excellent Courthouse News Service, a progressive super PAC brought this case to the freshly liberal majority state Supreme Court. After back in 2022, the high court back then had a 4-3 so-called conservative majority, and the justices had banned the use of ballot drop boxes for no particular reason other than finding that nothing in the state law permitted them to be used. Mind you, nothing in state law prohibited them from being used, but right-wingers gonna right-wing, you know.
Definitely.
In the lead opinion in that case, the horrible Justice Rebecca Grassl Bradley, a Scott Walker appointee, compared Dropbox's unlawful use to tyrants breaking the law to win elections. Allowing secure, convenient drop boxes is akin to tyrants breaking the law to win elections.
It's tyranny.
Mailboxes, for some reason, they're just fine. But a secure drop box, well, that's tyranny. In another opinion, back in 2020, the same justice, Bradley, had urged the court to overrule its decision in one of Donald Trump's failed challenges to Wisconsin's election results that year, saying that it gave the bipartisan Wisconsin Election Commission too much power. So the bipartisan Elections Commission in Wisconsin had too much power over elections in Wisconsin. The election, however, of Justice Janet Protasiewicz last year flipped the court from right-wing to liberal control for the first time in more than a decade. The new majority has since acted on challenges to some of its predecessors' most politically consequential actions, including a redistricting lawsuit that resulted in Republican gerrymandered legislative voting maps getting tossed and replaced with, you know, fairer maps that give Democrats at least better odds in many legislative races across the state. That drove the Republicans crazy, naturally. 2 years ago, the competing arguments over whether drop boxes were legal boiled down to whether the state's law, whether state law's silence on the matter meant that they were permitted or prohibited. State law said nothing either way, so they all fought about whether that meant they were allowed or not allowed. And of course, similar arguments were presented when the case again came before the new liberal 4-3 liberal majority court on Monday. And those arguments were made along similar partisan lines. Plaintiff's lawyer, David Fox, said the court's previous decision, quote, read a restriction into the statute that simply is not there, unquote. He argued that the statutory scheme only requires returning ballots to municipal clerks and says little to nothing about how that can actually be done. Fox noted there was no evidence of fraud, zero, or any other illegal conduct connected to drop boxes during the 2020 election. In fact, according to Washington Post's coverage of Monday's hearing, drop boxes had been used in some Wisconsin communities for years without any problems or challenges. They proliferated in 2020 because voters turned to absentee voting in unprecedented numbers due to the coronavirus pandemic. You might remember that. Both Republicans and Democrats in the state had initially embraced their use until Republicans decided to turn against them because Donald Trump argued that somehow they would help Democrats or something. More than half of U.S. states allow the use of ballot drop boxes, that according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. And again, there has been zero actual legitimate evidence of their misuse. In any way. Yes, Republicans put out this ridiculously debunked over and over movie called 2000 Mules, which claimed that drop boxes were being used by so-called ballot mules who were going around collecting ballots and illegally casting them. In swing state after swing state, they had cameras, videos on those drop boxes to prove it. Donald Trump said it was the greatest movie ever made. Republicans believed that everything in it was, you know, documented. Of course, those people who actually looked at the film with a critical eye noticed that, well, there's actually no evidence on any of those camera shots of anybody inappropriately mailing ballots. There was one, I can't remember if it was in Detroit or Atlanta. Obviously, the filmmakers focused, you know, only on big cities where Democrats vote a lot. But there was one person who dropped off and they said, look, he's got four or five ballots. Well, it turns out they tracked down the guy and he had four or five ballots because he's got four or five ballot family members who had cast their ballots. And yes, in, I think it was Georgia, you are allowed to cast to bring your family's ballot members, your family members' ballots to a drop box or a mailbox or to the county office to drop them off.
Yeah, but Republicans realize that a lot of their followers don't know anything about election law, so they prey on their ignorance.
They know nothing about it, and they're out there still today on social media saying, wow, I guess you haven't seen 2,000 Mules. everything in it has been debunked from top to bottom, including in states like Georgia, which are run by Republicans, where the Georgia Bureau of Investigations looked into the matter, shared the information with the FBI, and they found there was, yes, no evidence of actual fraud via these drop boxes. Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General Faye Hipsman represented the Wisconsin Elections Commission in this Dropbox case heard on Monday. The Wisconsin Election Commission is the nominal defendant in the PAC's lawsuit. They're the ones being sued, and the Assistant Attorney General said, quote, "The commission fully agrees that drop boxes are permitted under Wisconsin statutes." So even the people, even the commission being sued says, yeah, we have no problem with drop boxes. And then there was this amusing moment during Monday's oral argument on this. Misha Zeitlin, a Chicago-based attorney who was at one point Wisconsin's Solicitor General under the former Republican Governor Scott Walker, he opened his arguments for the legislature, who are trying to defend this, by noting that the court had already settled this matter 2 years ago. Zeitlin argued for maintaining stare decisis, which is the legal doctrine that emphasizes adherence to precedent, to settled law. That, in turn, prompted liberal Justice Jill Karofsky to quote, "None other than U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in his majority opinion in the Dobbs case that overturned Roe v. Wade." Justice Karofsky asked Zeitlin what the court should do if they thought the previous Dropbox decision was, quote, "egregiously wrong," using Alito's precise language for overturning 50 years of settled reproductive law. Zeitlin refuted the comparison, totally different. He maintained that, as noted in the previous decision 2 years ago, drop boxes present difficult questions of statutory interpretation that can lead to, quote, "reasonable disagreement between justices of good faith." Unlike, I guess, the totally simple questions presented by Roe v. Wade or something. I don't even know what this guy, Zeitlin, who frequently represents the Wisconsin currently Republican-controlled legislature in court, predicted that if the current court overturns the previous court's ruling, well, the issue of drop boxes would keep coming up whenever the court's composition changes. If the court is going to overturn just because they think the previous court got it wrong 2 years ago under the same argument, the justices, quote, "should just say stare decisis is dead," Zeitlin argued. And I don't know if the justices will say it, but I will say it. Yes, stare decisis is dead. Stare decisis has been killed, shot, poisoned, hung, murdered by the highest court in the land, the United States Supreme Court, over and over and over as its corrupted right-wing influence has grown over the years. After one Republican justice after another during their confirmation hearings in the U.S. Senate have pretended over and over and over again now for decades that they are believers in the well-established precedent and settled law. Yes, they're believers in stare decisis. That's what every single one of them said at their Senate confirmation hearings, only to then get into office and toss out every long-standing precedent that they have been able to once they're seated in their lifetime positions on the highest court of the land. So, yeah, stare decisis is dead, and I know exactly who murdered it. So please don't waste your breath, right-wing Republicans, pretending that we should still give a damn about settled law, about precedent, about stare decisis. When the question is about overturning one of your corrupt court rulings, especially a ruling that is meant to do nothing more than suppress democracy in these United States. A decision in this case is expected next month and could, of course, have Big implications for absentee voting in a crucial swing state where elections are routinely decided by thin margins. Joe Biden won the state in 2020 by just over 20,000 votes, a similar margin to Trump's margin of victory back in 2016. Anyway, I think that's a good news story out of Wisconsin.
We'll see. Good luck, Wisconsin.
At least for now. Green News is next. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Well, I guess it's one thing that Republicans are trying to undermine our democracy.
Yep.
It's another thing entirely, an even worse thing, that they're trying to undermine planet Earth.
Yep.
As discussed in our latest Green News Report.
Hopefully the town doesn't burn, you know. I never thought it'd be us, you know, until now.
Canada's fire season erupts, forcing evacuations as wildfire smoke chokes upper Midwest in the U.S. Record-breaking increase in carbon dioxide levels in the world's atmosphere, plus...
For decades, fossil fuel companies have lied and known that they've lied about their industry's impact on climate change.
Michigan becomes the latest state to sue Big Oil for mounting climate damages.
All of those damages and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Would I have thought that I would stand here on the House floor to defend my constituents' appliances and gas stoves?
I was proud to lead the House Republican effort to protect our gas stoves.
They can take our lives! But they can never take our cooktops.
This is your Green News Report.
No disrespect to any of these idiots.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I can't take it anymore with this saving the gas stoves nonsense from the Republicans who just don't want to do anything real. Certainly not about climate change, but what do you have for us today?
Well, first, some really not great news. A record-breaking increase in carbon dioxide levels in the world's atmosphere, according to researchers at Hawaii's Mauna Loa Observatory. In March, they recorded the largest annual leap in levels of planet-warming CO2 in the world's atmosphere, surpassing the record observed in 2016. CO2 emissions are rising because humans are burning more fossil fuels than ever. And it's an ominous sign of lagging efforts to curb global greenhouse gas emissions and address the accelerating damages from man-made global warming.
What accelerating damages?
Well, those rising CO2 emissions are driving an onslaught of unprecedented weather disasters on multiple continents over just the last few weeks, for example.
That damage.
Yeah, killing hundreds and displacing tens of thousands more. In war-torn Afghanistan, one of the world's poorest nations, weeks of unusually heavy seasonal rains triggered flash floods and mudslides across multiple provinces that have killed more than 300 people. Asia is still roasting in a deadly, weeks-long intense heat wave. Canada is already seeing an early, unusually intense fire season, made worse by years of drought and a below-normal snowpack this past winter. In Fort Nelson, British Columbia.
Getting ready for our sort of last stand, if that's what it comes to.
Rob Fraser, mayor of Fort Nelson, and other officials are trying to evacuate holdout residents as fire crews and emergency workers readied their last stand to save the town from a fast-moving wildfire sparked when high winds downed a tree onto a power line. It is one of several major out-of-control blazes in western Canada. Smoke from the fires has prompted air quality alerts from British Columbia to Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Well, now I'm sorry I asked about the accelerating damages.
In the U.S., the Federal Trade Commission has accused fracking CEO and Republican mega donor Scott Sheffield of conspiring with Saudi Arabia and OPEC in a price-fixing scheme to curtail oil production in 2021 and 2022 as inflation skyrocketed to push prices even higher at the public's expense.
Who could have guessed it?
Rising energy costs are a key driver of inflation. One estimate calculated that the price-fixing scheme cost the average American as much as $2,100 a year. Another concluded that the scheme may have been responsible for as much as a quarter of inflation. The Washington Post reports that disgraced former President Donald Trump told several big oil executives at a fundraiser last month to raise $1 billion for him to help him win the November election. In return, Trump said he would immediately reverse dozens of President Biden's environmental policies and rules and stop new ones from being enacted. Politico reports that the oil industry is already drawing up a slew of executive orders for Trump, should he win, to expand natural gas exports, increase offshore oil leases, and quickly reverse all of Biden's climate and environmental policies that limit oil and gas industry pollution.
Pay Donald Trump $1 billion, and these are the things he will give you.
Yep.
Sounds like a quid pro quo to me.
Finally, Michigan's Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel announced late last week that she is going to file suit against Big Oil to force fossil fuel companies to pay damages for knowingly causing climate change, which is costing the state dearly, she says, harming its economy, its agriculture products, tourism, culture, and infrastructure.
Just like the tobacco and opioid industries have had to reimburse the public for their role in harming public health, we're asking fossil fuel companies now to do the same. Michigan taxpayers didn't create this problem, and they shouldn't have to foot the bill to address it.
No, they shouldn't, but yes, they will. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, where you can share it with anyone you know, love, or hate. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button once there, or go to straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.